Members. We have enough for a quorum, so we'll call the meeting to order. I did see a bunch of us in the DOT cafeteria wolfing down our lunch. I hope you're all okay. It's part of the problem with having a 12:30 start time on a committee meeting is lunch gets in the way of getting over here. So this committee should probably have roll aids, I suppose, to pass around. There you go. So munch quietly. Remember, the microphones are hot, so push the mics back if you're chewing something crunchy. Well, we're going to call the meeting to order. I think the first order of business is the minutes, because the clerk just notes the roll. I'm sorry, the our assistant notes the roll. Minute approval. I'll entertain a motion. Anyone's seen them?
So move.
Representative Sanders moves the minutes. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Members, as we continue to our educational process on how things work around here and the things we've done in past legislators, especially for you folks who are new to the committee, we're happy to have with us today from DOT and Met Council an explanation on the urban partnership agreements. Actually, are there two or is there one? I know 35W is an urban partnership agreement. You'll get into that in just a moment. Mr. Nick Thompson, Mr. Craig Lamoth are here, and we're going to ask you to proceed with talking about UPAs. I'm thinking, members, if you have urgent questions that would help shed light on how things go or maybe be beneficial to the rest of the committee, give my attention and we'll be asking you questions as we proceed. So let's do that style of question and answer today, okay? Mr. Thompson, I presume.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Thompson, Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Craig Lamoth. I am representing Metropolitan Council. I'm actually with Metro Transit. I was the senior project manager for the UPA transit component.
And thank you for the opportunity to give an update today on the Urban Partnership Agreement, also known as UPA. And we'll go through what was accomplished, give some general background, and some early results that were also part of the Urban Partnership Agreement report that was delivered in the past week to the legislature.
Thank you.
The some background on Urban Partnership Agreement. This was a 2007 U.S. DOT initiative that was seeking innovative ways to address congestion. It was a competitive process where regions could put together applications to apply for funds. There was $1.1 billion in funds available for this program. The innovation and the applications that the US DOT sought were around projects around four T's: tolling, or as we call it around in Minnesota, congestion pricing; technology, transit, and telecommuting or telework. Twin Cities was one of five of the competitive grants that was initially awarded funds. For this, we received $133 million in federal funds, which was matched by state funds of roughly $50 million, which we'll break down in a little bit. We funded 26 separate individual projects within our Urban Partnership Agreement grant. The focus of our program was on the 35W corridor, Highway 77 or Cedar Avenue, and then downtown Minneapolis. The initial five cities that received over $1 billion in federal funds: New York, Twin Cities, Seattle, San Francisco, and Miami. These funds were somewhat unique in that you had specific deadlines that if you did not meet those deadlines, your funds were taken back and given to other cities. So in the end, the cities that received the funds that are moving forward with projects, New York and Chicago were unable to deliver their program as their application had. San Francisco was not able to completely deliver, so those funds were reprogrammed to Los Angeles and Atlanta. With the federal funds, it was federal funds from five separate USDOT programs, four of them for highway-type projects, one for transit. The state fund breakdowns was a combination of trunk highway bonds, GO bonds, some regional transit capital bonds, some general fund, which went to the telework program, some highway funds, and just some other miscellaneous smaller amounts of funds. This was the PE at UPA stands for partnership. This was a very unique approach to transportation projects in our metro and for the U.S., where we had a lot of different entities that were leads or partners in delivering these innovative applications.
Mr. Thompson, excuse me just a moment. Back on page 2, you talked about the general fund, $3.2 million. What did you say about Kenilworth?
The $3.2 million in general fund went to the telework program or the telecommuting program. That was the only source of the general funds.
Thank you. That explained. Thank you.
The stars indicate which of the four T categories we had projects in, and the numbers are within that is the agency that led that and how many projects they were leading. For instance, Metro Transit led 5 transit projects on here. MnDOT had 4 separate projects making up the tolling component. We had partners at the city of Minneapolis led the largest project in downtown Minneapolis. Minnesota Valley Transit had lead projects. Metro Transit, the University of Minnesota played a key role in this also on some of their efforts. Mm-hmm. So it was a very large group. The centerpiece, one of the centerpieces of this was the kind of the remake of 35W. This is the remake of 35W from the southern metro to downtown Minneapolis. And it's really the vision for what a highway corridor can be for the 21st century. It involves the ability, provides users of that corridor with choices. Choices in what mode they use, choices in how they are informed about what's going on in real time on that corridor, choices on any given day to have a congestion-free trip if they pay a price using the MinPass system. It connects, integrates the transit components, the park and rides, the BRT stops, it's a future BRT, and it has a lot of technology there to make that corridor operate safely. It also has some of our innovative low-cost, high-benefit projects where we use technology or different designs to fit new capacity into the corridor in a more compact design where you can deliver that at a much lower cost and a much quicker time frame. The results is that we have a sustainable way to have congestion-free options for commuters, not just on a day-to-day basis, but we believe in the long-term commuters will have these choices and have congestion-free choices into the future. Some background on our tolling. If you're unfamiliar, we call our system in Minnesota the MinPass system. It's in other terms you use it for is high occupancy tolling, which means you have carpools of 2 or more people that get to use the system for free. Buses get to use the lane for free. In our case, we allow motorcycles to use it for free. And then if you're driving solo in your car, no passengers, you can pay a price or a toll to use the MinPass lane. We started the system in 2005 on 394, and that installation was we had an existing carpool lane out there that was not working well. It was underperforming. So we made a change there where we allowed solo drivers to use that. What was unique about that was the first in its kind anywhere in the world where you took a lane next to general purpose lanes and priced it and tried to operate it at a different speed, always be congestion free. That's been very successful there. It continues to operate on 394. We took that same concept and applied it to 35W. But 35W did not have a carpool lane the entire length of the corridor. It only had the existing lane from roughly Burnsville to the 494 area. And so we converted that to a MinPass lane. Within the Crosstown project, which opened in November, they constructed a MinPass lane within that. That was the plan to build a HOV lane, but we opened it as a MinPass lane instead. In the northern section, which we call PDSL, so if you got specific legislative authority to allow during peak times, use technology to allow cars to operate on the shoulder and make the shoulder a general or a priced MinPass lane during peak time. And then when it's off peak, when there's no need for that capacity, where traffic levels are lower, say midday, late at night, or some weekends, the lane is closed off and can be used for emergency breakdowns or for emergency purposes for drivers as a typical shoulder.
Mr. Thompson, on that dynamic shoulder, is that the inside shoulder inside the high speed? They don't make them go to the outside, right?
Yes, in this case it is the inside shoulder and connects up well with the MinPass lane just to the south. Mm-hmm. And then the exit into downtown is also on the left side, so it feeds really well. Sets up very nicely for a MinPass on the inside shoulder.
Thank you.
And then next year, partially we used some, we had some extra UPA funds. We're using that along with some transit funds, transit bond allocated with Chapter 152 to fund the expansion of MinPass in Burnsville next year. We're building a northbound MinPass lane connecting up with the existing lane. That will be started construction and finished this year, should open to the public by the end of the calendar year. Mm-hmm. A question came from on about some of the background on the cost of construct tolling and some of the operating costs and revenue related to that. For 394, we spent $10 million roughly in capital to add the tolling infrastructure and back office to that system. On 35W, it's a lot more complicated. We spent $3.4 million in the tolling infrastructure for 35W, but of course we had to construct a lane through the crosstown, the shoulder lane. So this cost only reflects the tolling infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include the bigger costs. It's a different breakdown for 35W. Looking at the operating costs in the year that the contract year that ended in spring of 2010. We had operating costs of $1.93 million. That includes the cost to operate the toll infrastructure in the back office and the enforcement cost. And we had revenue in that same time frame of $1.71 million.
And that includes both 394 and 35W?
Correct. A note on the operating costs. Prior to 35W, our operating costs were about $1.2 million. When you add a second road, you do not double your operating costs. You get some efficiencies by adding the second road.
Understood. Pause for questions. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall a few years ago that we had a presentation on 394, mm-hmm. and the story at the time picked up in the newspaper was that when you add capital and operating costs, there was no way this was a break-even, 394. And I look at that, and I'm not altogether convinced that 35W will be either.
Correct.
Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not expect that you would recapture the capital cost. We fully expect our operating costs, our revenue will exceed our annual operating costs. I think we're already there, especially this full year of 35W now that the Crosstown project will open. We expect revenues to be not greatly over operating costs, but they will be over operating costs. But the capital costs, especially for 35W, with constructing the lane and constructing the shoulder, are much higher than 394.
And Mr. Chair, my understanding also is that there's sort of still a major, major problem that has to be fixed with another capital investment, because there's very awkward cross traffic that's going to have to go on because.
Representative Hausman, what part of this system
on,
are you thinking?
On the 35W, at once it's within the...
At this time,
Mr.
as Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 35W is operating very safely. It's working very well. There are certain commuters that maybe would use MinPass, certain trips that wouldn't be able to use MinPass because they'd have to merge across all the lanes, and if they're only going a shorter distance or going to a connecting freeway, it wouldn't make sense for them to use MinPass. But we have no extra costs that we're anticipating to make it operate any better.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman.
I'm looking. Oh, there's Representative Hornstein.
The question you were thinking about.
Because don't we have a huge request coming this year?
To this point, Representative Hornstein?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, Mr. Thompson, I think you might be referring to the issue that we have with Lake Street.
Oh.
and what's happening there, particularly with the buses. And first of all, let me just thank you because, for the members, Mr. Thompson was very involved in this from the start. We had a number of community meetings. A lot of the, we had a transit station in my district and a number of the changes with 35 and construction impacts. And you were always really helpful, and I appreciate that. But on Lake Street, we have a problem because there's not an inline station there. And so the buses have to cross, four lanes of traffic, and it's very, it's problematic. And I think this whole effort would be enhanced if we were able to have an inline station at Lake Street. And I'm wondering if, how the agency is handling that in terms of planning. We would like to see bonding for that, and is this something that the agency recognizes and is also working towards?
Mr. Thompson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I apologize. That, the question is, at 46th Street, if you're a bus using MinPass Lane, you have a bus stop on the left side that you can exit off. And the next bus station on the northbound is on Lake Street, which is on the right side. Mm-hmm. So, yes, buses do have to cross if they're serving both facilities and then cross back to get into downtown Minneapolis. I'm not involved in the Lake Street study, but I know a study is underway, and I'm sure we can follow up with some additional information regarding that, unless Craig has some information we can add.
The only thing I'd like to add, Mr. Chair and committee members, is the buses that pre-UPA and pre-MinPass on 35W, buses were operating on the bus-only shoulders on the right side, maxed out at 35 miles per hour, usually a lot less than that, usually only 15 miles per hour over stop traffic. So the buses now today, even though we have to make a maneuver that we'd like to see go away, that we have to cut across from the left side to the right side to serve that Lake Street stop, those buses are still today operating faster than they were when they used to be on the bus-only shoulders, mm-hmm. because we're able to go 50 miles an hour on the MinPass lanes for the full length of the corridor. But we're not getting the maximum benefit, so.
Well, just an observation. We'll move to some other questions that members have. The northern limits of this UPA project that was completed a couple years ago was about 42nd Street, wasn't it? And it is my understanding that another segment will be constructed or could be in the future moving forward more towards downtown that would continue the BRT type of center stations, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we opened the UPA projects in two phases. Mm-hmm. The first phase, we opened the northern limits from 42nd Street to downtown in 2009, okay. and then the piece within the crosstown project limit opened in November of this year. So we've had that entire stretch open now since November 19th.
Okay.
The UPA does have even further northern projects in as far as Blaine for Park and Ride, but we don't. And then there's a plan for BRT stations all along on several spots on 35W, including Lake Street, mm-hmm. And also further south.
Well, perhaps, members, when we get into a BRT discussion here in another week or so, this will be a great topic for us to discuss here, because the center position stations certainly are faster, more safer, and more efficient. So we'll want to kind of explore that a little more with you. Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just, again, observation for the committee. You know, the one concern, of course, that I have about BRT is unless it's in a dedicated right-of-way, mm-hmm. Is it really bus rapid transit, or is it very expensive bus service? And if it's caught up in the same traffic problems that cars are, and the reason I make that observation is I hear in the discussion this sense that somehow bus rapid transit is the way for us to go in this region, that somehow it's much less expensive. But I think we've got to be a little more careful in terms of how we look at the totals and look at the outcomes and before we make that judgment. A number of years ago, national peers came in and did a peer review of our Metro Transit and gave them very, very high marks. Their only negative was that they said this region too quickly moves toward bus rapid transit without subjecting it to the same kinds of measurements that we do all of the other modes.
Well, that kind of scrutiny is what the committee will be doing, and I'm looking forward to it. Engaging that discussion. I don't know if we've talked a lot about it or you've picked it up from the committee, but you certainly have picked it up if the chairman's been quoted in local newspapers, because I've said those very things. So thank you for pointing that out to the committee. Representative Nelson, thank you for your patience. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And some of my question was asked by Representative Hausman, but it tweaked me as I was reading the materials that were handed out here and what you said about what was said by the testifier about not recovering the full amount of it, that we're in some way subsidizing these people that are using the hot lanes. But on this sheet that was passed out here that says that they're supposed to, excess money generated is supposed to go into for capital improvements along the UPI. Mm-hmm. And if we're not recovering the full amount of the cost of operating it, then when are we ever going to get the improvements out of it? Are we looking forward to doing that in the future? Or?
Mr. Thompson, as you're answering it, would you perhaps delineate the revenue between the 394 operations and what we've had just in the brief time on 35. That might help answer the question. Are we cash flowing either one of those, or
right? The there's a couple points there. How we allocate the revenue and the costs from this is dictated by the legislation that's passed, and each corridor has its own rules. On 394, the legislation requires that we first pay back the source of funds that funded the project, and so we're using all the revenue on 394 is going back to pay back that. Where we got the money to build the infrastructure, and then we're using operating dollars to pay the operating. So, and then on 35W, the legislation requires that we all revenue gets split between us and the transit agencies on that corridor after the first year. And so, actually, after as the legislation stands this year, we will distribute some of the revenue to Metro Transit. I believe it'll be for 35W, and it'll be. I think we're on track predicting here from $400,000 to $600,000 in revenue for 35W this year, whereas 394 is about 1.2 to 1.4 million in revenue. I'm just estimating forward that could change. So there'll actually be revenue distributed for improvements faster, or for transit service on the corridor faster from 35W, just because of the differences in legislation. After 2013, I expect that we'll have met our commitment to pay back the capital costs on 394 the way we're paying for it, and then we'll still be exceeding our operating costs on 394, so some money may be able for distribution at that point, but the numbers you see behind me are small compared to the cost of projects, cost of transit service on some of these. So this from the beginning, though, just to recall, this was not a system set up to maximize revenue. It was a system set up to use pricing to guarantee a congestion-free trip. So that goal we are achieving, but it's not at all set up to generate a tremendous amount of revenue based on this.
Thank you for the question. Follow-up, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thompson, this probably just got answered from a revenue side of it, but I was wondering whether or not you're meeting your projections for MPAS participation.
Mr. Thompson?
Yes, members of the committee, we did not do any projections for 35W, so I wouldn't estimate. I guess I don't have anything to compare it against. We've been very happy with how it's performing from in terms of we're operating at or above 50 miles an hour almost all the time. And I consider December to be like the first month on 35W because the crosstown was completed. And 35W is operating just like the first month of 394 5 years ago. So the corridor is operating very similarly. We continue to grow. 394 continues to grow every month. We have growth in use and growth in revenue, though it's small. It's grown throughout the economic downturn, even though we've had a drop in trips on our system. So our growth is slow. So we're extremely satisfied that we are delivering as promised for the goals. But I didn't have it. We didn't do any projections for what would be the expected number of users or expected number of revenue.
Thank you. I think we're questioned out at the moment. Keep talking. We'll think of some more, Mr. Thompson.
Just the example here of this price dynamic shoulder view. If you're driving down this corridor and you're looking out your windshield, you would see this is a section from 42nd Street to downtown Minneapolis, roughly about a little over 2 miles. What's kind of what's truly innovative about this is two things. We added a lane to the busiest freeway in the state of Minnesota, and we didn't widen the road. We did that by repurposing the shoulder and using technology to make it safe. Technology is over every single lane. We have a dynamic message sign every half mile that tells the driver about what's going on in the lane ahead. We call this system the Smart Lane System. It's the first of its kind in the country, especially first of its kind to combine this active management of traffic on every lane with pricing in the left lane. So this, as I mentioned, the busiest stretch of road in Minnesota, we're able to add this over 2 miles of capacity to that corridor for a little over $15 million. In general, that's what you call a bargain in terms of the highway investments. The other thing is we're able to do this in roughly a five-month construction period. So for the impact that you would have from construction, of a typically rebuilding a roadway and adding a lane and widening it out, possibly affecting property owners adjacent to that. We did not have that on this type of project. We had a lot of design issues and things we had to go through and with our partners, but it is operating. We're very satisfied with how this is operating, and it really is a potential for other types of projects for quick delivery in the corridor. And so far, so another thing that was introduced too on those dynamic message signs is variable speed limits. We again were the first in its nation in the nation to do this. Seattle is also doing this. They launched it very soon after we did, where we vary the advisory speed to drivers for each lane or for each section. So if you're driving down 35W and you're maybe going 55 miles an hour, but a mile or so ahead it's much lower traffic, we're slowly advising you to lower your speeds. The outcome we expect of this is reduced rear-end crashes and smoother traffic flow. And both of those things make the road safer and also allow the road to handle more traffic and have less congestion. We have had this going since midsummer, and we don't have our results yet, but so far the motorists seem to be understanding it well, and we have a good evaluation underway to see if we're getting the safety benefits we expected and also the performance related to congestion. The shoulder lane also, because it was really when you have a lane of traffic that's only a lane sometimes, you really have to think about how you can make that to the driver be safe so they know whether it's a lane or a shoulder, so they can properly merge in or out, or if they feel a flat tire or run out of gas or have an emergency, they feel they can be safely pulling over on the shoulder when it's closed in the shoulder. So we have not only overhead technology that is dynamically managed from our traffic management center, We have lighting in the road that is in-road LED lighting that basically we alternate where the stripes are based on whether you should merge or whether you can safely use that lane. We were unsure if that in-road lighting would survive a Minnesota winter with our snowplows, but it's made it through two and has operated very well. Motorists really respond to this. It's kind of like runway lights in the road. They respond well, and I think it opens up some other opportunities for dynamically managing lanes by time of day with in-road lighting and overhead signs. Some of the early results, which are listed in your legislative report, also from the highway investments. We are maintaining that congestion-free trip more than 95% of the time, probably closer to 98%. We are required by law to operate that lane at 45 miles an hour or greater 90% of the time. That's the federal regulation for a min-pass type lane. That calendar year of 2010, we had 473,000 trips that were tolled. There's also, these are not counting the carpool use of that lane, which significant carpool use on 35W, or the transit ridership, also users of that lane. These are MinPass lanes, if you're not familiar, also don't operate 24 hours a day. And so when they're not outside the peak period, anybody can use the lane for free. And so those trips are not counted in that. As I mentioned before, December 2010 was really our first full month of operation where the entire system was online. It was a very snowy month that got a lot of use and performed well. And the safety results for 35W are pending, but I can say from 394, every year that since we opened in 2005, we've seen a decrease in crashes, year-over-year decrease in crashes on the 394 corridor. Whether that's all attributed, we're not saying that's all attributed to MinPass, but we know that tells us that this type of lane can operate safely within an existing highway corridor.
Mr. Thompson, on the MinPass lane on 35, was it an incident here a while ago where there was a crash on the hill coming up out of the river that had the two right lanes blocked? Is it possible for MnDOT to open the MinPass lane during a crash event like that to help traffic get around?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have operating rules for incidents related to whether or not you override the tolling, and that is done by an operator at the traffic management center. So they have rules. If they're blocking certain lanes, we're supposed to basically open the lane to all users and then use our smart lane system to guide people around that system. I know of instances where we've done that. That particular incident, I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll touch briefly on our telework program. Of the five communities that telework was supposed to be a big component of a UPA, Minnesota, far and away, had the biggest telework program. Also, I think we've had tremendous success. We partnered with employers targeted on the 35W corridor so that we're trying to not only do the transit, all these investments related to the corridor, we're also trying to get people to avoid peak periods through telework, flex work, traditional telework where you work from home for a day or more, and also a system pioneered by at Best Buy called Results Only Work Environment. We did piloting of that in several businesses that basically all your hours are based on the results given to you or expected of you, and that's been a success too. We had goals of 500 employees teleworking once a week, but we far and away exceeded that. And there's a lot of employees work, and this program is still up and running. We're trying to have it continue to be run through our traffic management organizations that also provide ride shares and work well with employers. eworkplace-mn.com is the website that we directed employers to and employees. And, you know, 10 years ago, telework issues were around technology. Those technology issues are really gone. It's really about policies and type of work being performed, and it's amazing the type of work that you would traditionally think couldn't be done from remote spots that now can be. So it's really an opportunity to address congestion without having to do investments. And it's really for the individual, it's that same choice. They have the choice to avoid congestion wherever they can if they have a flexible work environment or a MinPass system or ability to use transit. All those are choices for this corridor. I'll turn it over to Craig to cover the transit investments.
Thank you, Mr. Lamont.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. The Transit T is likely the largest and was the most challenging in terms of the number of agencies involved in implementing the program, as well as the number of projects, as well as the total funding. It was by far the largest of the four Ts as part of our program. When we pursued the UPA funding, we set out four goals for improving the lives of the transit customer. We wanted to improve trip reliability, decrease trip travel time, increase facility and vehicle capacity, and inform commuter choices. All of the projects that you're going to see on the subsequent slides were in various planning stages, some a little further along than others. And fortunately for that, that was the only way we were able to deliver it within the tight schedule we had. These were not projects that were not already on the drawing boards. They had already been moving along. They were just short on funding. Some of them were already partially funded. The crown jewel of our transit program was the reconstruction of Marquette and 2nd Avenue in downtown Minneapolis, what we affectionately call Mark II. This was co-led by City of Minneapolis, who did the bricks and mortar portion of it, and Metro Transit, which focused on the technology piece of it. Essentially what this project was a rebuilding block, building face to building face, 24 blocks, 12 on each street, in the heart of downtown. What resulted was side-by-side reverse running bus lanes, wider sidewalks on both sides, enhanced streetscape including over 200 street trees, custom shelters, and a lot of technology, both transit and roadway technology. Our goal was to create a 21st century express bus corridor in the heart of downtown. We wanted to triple the bus carrying capacity of those two streets, which prior to this project had a single bus line on each one. We wanted to reduce bus travel times by up to 10 minutes through downtown Minneapolis. The outcome of this, I have a great video, but I didn't want to take up the committee's time showing it, but we essentially transformed what was previously a conga line of buses slowly moving down these two streets into a ballet of buses. If you ever have an opportunity to go to downtown Minneapolis in the PM peak and get into one of the skyways over either Marquette or 2nd, it's quite impressive to see how these buses now move down the street. We were able with this project to consolidate most of the express bus service that was scattered throughout downtown Minneapolis onto these two streets. And we were the first one in the country to implement a double bus lane, two bus stops per block, skip-stop operation in the nation. Portland has something similar. We made ours a little more complicated. The next set of projects are essentially the brick-and-mortar expansion of our bus capacity as well as our park-and-ride facility capacity. We built six park-and-rides as well as bought a 27 buses with this part of the project. Metro Transit built four of the facilities and purchased the buses, and Minnesota Valley Transit Authority built the other two facilities. Going from left to right and top to bottom, you'll see the Cedar Grove or Lakeville Cedar Transit Station. This is a roughly a 200 space park and ride, and it is also the interim end of the bus rapid transit corridor for Cedar Avenue, which you'll hear a little bit later with the other presenters today. We have the Cedar Grove Transit Station, which is located in Eagan. That's also roughly another 200 spaces. That provides direct bus service to the University of Minnesota, so it's a very unique market that it's serving. Then we have the Apple Valley Transit Station, which was a 750-space park and ride, and more importantly, it was the region's first side-platform BRT station. Unless you live down in this area, you don't see it as often as you would see the 46th Street BRT station on 35W in South Minneapolis, which is a center-running BRT, and that's because we anticipate that the MinPass system will act as the BRT lanes on 35W, and the BRT lanes on Highway 77 will actually be on the outside shoulders. So what this image shows here is the northbound station platform with a skyway crossing about 8 lanes of a county roadway connecting to a southbound platform on the other side. The next one off in the middle right-hand side of the slide is the 95th Avenue Park and Ride in Blaine. It is now our largest park and ride facility in the region at over 1,400 spaces. The next one, the lower left, is County Road C Park and Ride in Roseville. It's quite unique in that it has a 100% recycled aluminum skin, which is what makes it translucent in nature. And the last one is the Kenrick Avenue Park and Ride in Lakeville on 35W. This is also unique in that it is a concave, I guess, shaped park and ride because it had to fit the right-of-way that we had there. This is a former commercial vehicle way station that MnDOT and the state used to have. It had long since been deactivated. One other aspect of this project is we reactivated the former on and off ramps for the commercial vehicles for buses only, which provides a huge transit benefit for those who use this facility. In the end, we constructed over 2,800 new park and ride spaces, bought 27 buses, and probably most importantly, as we moved along the advancement of the park and ride component of both the Cedar Avenue BRT corridor and the 35W BRT corridor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in particularly how the park and rides are doing in some of the suburban communities on 35 South, Lakeville. Has this increased the capacity of Burnsville, which is already a popular one?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair and committee members. I've got a whole slide at the end that will touch on some of the early results, but overall, 51% of the spaces we built are already full today. It varies facility by facility, and I can get to some of that a little bit later on as well. The Burnsville one, the Kenrick Avenue facility in Lakeville is probably the biggest success story. That one, we've got 40% new riders. Previously, before the facility, were not in the system. And then probably as equally important is 60% of the users at that facility formerly drove in congested traffic, adding to the problem on the roadways up to Burnsville or up to Apple Valley to hop on transit there. So kind of double bang for our dollar.
Thank you.
Representative Szymanski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lamoth, when you talk about the parking places in these park and ride facilities, do you measure the occupants of the vehicles parking there? You know, how many, is it multiple people in a vehicle that park at that facility and then get on the bus, or how is there a way to measure that?
Mr. Lamont?
That's also a good question. We occasionally do surveys. We also are out there for visual checks. As it relates to park and rides, most of these folks are coming one person per vehicle. We also have folks that drive their bike up. We actually have quite a few folks because the Kenrick Avenue facility, again, down in Lakeville, is immediately situated to a fairly dense residential suburban neighborhood, so we have a lot of bike up there as well. We also have a lot of drop-off, what we call kiss and ride, at the park and rides as well. But most of those who are showing up in cars showing up alone. There's a handful that are showing up together.
I knew that would get you.
Thank you. Continue.
The next set of projects, very similar to the park and rides, was a set of projects, and these were our transit technology projects that were led by various different agencies depending on the project, which included the University of Minnesota's ITS Institute, Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and Metro Transit. Again, going from left to right, the first two images are of the driver assist system, which was essentially installing high technology on 10 buses that operate on Cedar Avenue going to downtown Minneapolis. Again, this project was also one of those unique features of our UPA, being the first deployment in the world of this type of system. Essentially, the system provides driver feedback through the steering column, vibration through the seat cushion, as well as having heads-up displays. It's not quite a fighter jet cockpit, but it's getting close to that, and the buses don't drive themselves. They essentially provide feedback to allow the operators to
stay centered on the very, very narrow bus-only shoulders that we have in the region. The next set of images in the middle of the screen are our next trip real-time bus arrival and departure signs, mostly deployed on Marquette and 2nd Avenues, but also at 4 park and rides along the corridor. Essentially, these are providing bus times to customers, not only on these signs, but on the phone system, as well as on our website, which is accessible by computer or by smartphone. One of the unique features here is the very small image that looks like a pole with a speaker on it and a button. These are located in downtown Minneapolis on Marquette and 2nd, and these are ADA accessible enunciators, essentially providing the same information that's visible on these signs to the visibility challenged community that we serve. The last of the signs are real-time travel time comparison signs, which were also located in 4 locations. These are first in the country, the ones that compare auto to bus travel time, which is one of those information tools for folks. It's comparing the buses operating in either bus-only shoulders on the north side or on the south side, the min-pass lanes, as compared to autos driving in the general-purpose lane. And then we also have the park and ride space availability signs, which when lit either show full or not full. 4 locations along the UPA corridors were outfitted so they can actually count the cars going in and out, so we have an accurate account of when the facilities are full, because our facilities do get full, particularly later in the AM peak period. So if you go visit that one of those facilities and show up and you have no parking space, that can kind of discourage you from trying transit. Going along with these signs, if you happen to encounter a full facility, there's a sign just downstream from it that then tells you what the next facility is and whether there's any space available. It's probably my favorite of the UPA Transit projects, one of those low-cost, high-capacity projects. This project cost about $750,000. It was very innovative by the staff at MnDOT who led this project. They essentially created a bus-only left-turn lane and actuated signal for buses going northbound on Highway 77 wanting to go westbound on 62, which is what most of the traffic in this segment wants to do every morning. And on bad mornings, it can queue up almost back to the Mall of America for folks who want to make that tight clover leaf to go westbound. Buses no longer have to do this. Some of the early results from the transit projects. One of the few benefits of the economic downturn resulted in numerous and competitive bids for our brick and mortar projects. We actually were able to build twice as many park and ride spaces as we originally budgeted for when we submitted that application to USDOT back in 2007. So I mentioned before, 40% of the daily users at Kenrick Avenue are new customers. We also have incurred new customers at some of the other facilities as well. We've also relieved some facilities like the Burnsville Transit Station, the Apple Valley Transit Station, that were severely overburdened, getting folks off the road sooner rather than later. Buses on Central Avenue, which is one of the technology projects that I couldn't really display in a visual, forgot to mention, was we put transit signal priority in 27 intersections on Central Avenue in Minneapolis and Columbia Heights. Those buses are now moving faster and more reliably than before. The buses on Marquette and 2nd are also operating 60% faster than they were in the before condition. And then that little transit advantage on Highway 77-62, each bus is saving about 90 seconds, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when it's fully loaded in the morning coming from Dakota County, that's 75 minutes of transit travel time savings. A little bit about the evaluation that's going on both nationally of our UPA as well as locally. There's national interest, obviously, in this new approach that USDOT commissioned in 2006, which led them to commission a giant before and after study of not only our UPA, but all of the UPA and CRD cities. That effort is led by Battelle Memorial Institutes. The evaluation looks at a whole series of questions as it relates to things like congestion, goods movements, cost-benefit, business impact, equity. As it relates to our project, we are currently in the midst of the after data collection. We anticipate that a final report on our UPA and its success will come out in the second quarter of 2012. In addition to the national evaluation, there's other local evaluations being done on a qualitative and quantitative business basis. Probably one of the more interesting ones is one that's being done by the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota that is looking at the collaborative partnership piece of UPA. How do you do it? Is it successful? What are some challenges to replicating it?
Lastly, in addition to these projects, we definitely wanted to take the positive things that we take out of that and extend it to our other components of the things we do, Transit and MnDOT. Just a couple examples we have here of how the projects and the lessons learned from 35W are being transferred. Our smart lane system is going to be installed on I-94 between downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis as part of our way to enhance the transit service and also to safely keep the capacity that was added after the bridge collapse for the detour routing between Highway 280 and downtown. So that will be under construction and open at the end of this year. It won't include a MinPass system this year, but it's in our planning. We see that corridor as a potential future MinPass corridor sometime in the future.
Is that on, Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
Is that on 35E?
Now, the second bullet, 35E, we're in the planning stage of... We have a major project to replace what we call the Cayuga Bridge.
Yeah, there you go.
And with that, we are studying whether we can fit a MinPass lane within that corridor between downtown St. Paul and Little Canada Road or 694. That was an outcome of a MinPass system study that was completed in the fall, last fall, that suggested that could be a well-performing MinPass corridor and could tie in very well with the timing of the Cayuga Highway project.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are also moving forward now with an expansion of not only our next trip real-time signage, but also transit signal priority. We've been aided with the award last year by another smaller competitive federal grant that we received, and we're moving forward right now in the design and planning stages, and we'll be deploying it soon in other corridors. Another thing that we learned with the UPA and the tough schedule we were faced with trying to deploy it was that we really need to communicate with our project stakeholders, and often. A lot of these projects, even though they're in the planning stages, these were projects that were normally absent of funding before UPA came along, and the expectation was that we weren't going to get to them for a while. Well, then we turned the tables and basically started doing these overnight, literally, and had to communicate constantly, particularly with the condensed schedule. We essentially, for example, with Marquette and Second, shut down two streets in downtown for the most part for well over a construction site season. And we needed to communicate with all the visitors to downtown, the residents, the property managers and owners, and the employees so that they could still get around with their lives for that construction cycle. We were also used heavily for the first time, at least in transit, 3D video simulation to not only show folks what the project was going to deliver when it was done, but also, particularly with Marquette Second again, what the new operation was going to be. Again, it was very different. It's never been done anywhere else in the country. And then one of the other things that we learned from this that we've been able to use on other projects is the very tight schedule that was given to us, almost unrealistic schedule, forced us to relook at how we delivered projects. So we were really able to come up with some new innovative techniques in all phases of project delivery to be able to deliver these projects that would have otherwise taken 2 to 3 times as long as they actually took when we delivered them with UPA.
Is that that? Mark's the end and open more questions.
Mr. Chair, Lamoth, I know you're with the Met Council. The project delivery techniques, are those available to MnDOT as well? Did everyone involved learn from that whole adventure?
Through this collaboration, we're sharing information continuously.
MnDOT also, Mr. Chair, deployed and learned a lot of new techniques for rapid delivery also and communications with stakeholders.
Good deal. That should apply to all the MnDOT districts for all of you around the table. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lamont, and thank you. You also came to the neighborhood and helped out. Do you have any early data on usage of the 46th Street inline station? I know we've had issues with weather and snow and piles of snow all over the place, but how's that going so far?
Mr. Lamont?
It's a good question. 46th Street BRT station wasn't part of the UPA. It's just been recently opened. It's part of the UPA corridor. The usage has been, I believe, where we would like it to be, but it's also only been open for a matter of about a month and a half. And until we get probably 12 months of experience under our belt, we won't have a real good idea of where we stand on that.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I asked our operators, our Regional Traffic Management Center, about these buses moving back and forth between 46 and Lake Street, if they had noticed any safety issues, if they had heard from, like, the first drivers or State Patrol of any safety issues in that first month, and they indicated to me that they hadn't heard of any particular issues, but from a safety standpoint, you need a lot more time to evaluate that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Any other questions for these testifiers before we move to Cedar Avenue bus rides and transit? Gentlemen, we appreciate the report and the testimony. I see on your timeline we have some more built-in reports coming up over the next 18 months or so. We'll look forward to updates.
Thank you.
Now on Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transit, Ms. Nancy Showweiler and Mr. Sam O'Connell. Good you made it. Good deal. And you would be Ms. Showalter?
Yes.
If you did, there are people listening on the internet at home. If you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. We're dealing from these slides?
Yes.
Good deal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I'm Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Schuweiler. I am the chair of our legislative work group for the county board, and also in the audience today is Commissioner Will Branning, who is the chair of our Regional Rail Authority for Dakota County.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, before I turn this over to our transit specialist, Sam O'Connell, who is the expert on Cedar Avenue, I just want to enlighten the committee today and also share my appreciation for the opportunity to let you know a little bit about Cedar BRT in Dakota County. But I just want to say that I think with the information that it will be before this committee in the next few weeks, it is my opinion in learning about bus rapid transit and our Cedar Avenue project that there are different types of transit that work for different areas, and we found that BRT was an excellent choice for Cedar Avenue. And it's my belief that it doesn't necessarily work in every location, but I don't think light rail would have been the answer for us on Cedar either. I'll be open to questions at any point in time, but I'll turn this over to Sam O'Connell.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner. Ms. O'Connell,
thank you,
welcome
Mr.
to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll share with you, as Commissioner Schuweiler said, some of the reasons why bus rapid transit was right for Dakota County and the Cedar Avenue. We'll actually walk through a few of the elements that make the corridor rapid, the R and BRT, and provide with you a little bit more information of what our timelines, too, are as we move forward. But just as a little bit of background, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transit has been in the process for a long time, so much so that it has been included in the regional's transportation policy plan for the last few years. And although the vision that you see here is from the 2030 Regional Transit Way vision, Cedar Avenue has been basically in development for the last 14 to 15 years. The reason why we have the slide here is that we show where Cedar Avenue is located versus the rest of the region's transit improvements. And I would like to mention, and as you've heard today, we do have another bus rapid transit corridor in Dakota County, which is the I-35 BRT corridor. So we do have two BRT corridors in Dakota County, and that puts us, I believe, in a very unique position to understand what this can do for the region. Just a little bit of background in terms of why BRT was sort of the right solution for Cedar Avenue. The slide here shows some of the growth that we've anticipated, that we've experienced, and that we anticipate in Dakota County. The red circle kind of represents, that circle is the city of Apple Valley. And you can see from 1980 to 2000 how that's sort of being filled in terms of development. In 2030, of course, clearly filled in, and then we have other development that is occurring south of there in Lakeville. So you see that if you took that circle and you split it in half, that's about where the Cedar Avenue is. So City of Eagan to the north, Apple Valley, and Lakeville. So clearly when it comes to growing communities, we also experience some growing pains. The numbers that you see here are some of the numbers that were developed during our preliminary engineering phase of the project. And basically, if you look at the middle number there, Cedar Avenue at County Road Highway 42, today we're at about 70,000 average daily traffic, and that's comparable to I-35W in some segments. So on a principal arterial, we are actually handling some of the same amount of traffic that you would see on I-35W in Lakeville and in Burnsville. Clearly, that almost doubles by 2030. And if we are to handle this congestion in the traffic and the movement that people would want, we knew that we needed some alternatives. This is another sort of straight line diagram of some of what those congestion problems may be in the future. Again, in about 2005, we're about 46,000 average daily traffic volumes on there. What we see around 2011 is when the system really begins to break down. So basically this year, if we did absolutely nothing, our system begins to break down on Cedar Avenue. Granted, that line will probably it's a little bit more depressed because of the economic situation, but truly we find ourselves in a situation that Cedar Avenue would become a rolling parking lot in the very near future. And with that, our average speeds go down. And as we know, both citizens and businesses do not care to sit in traffic on Cedar Avenue. So this is just an example of how those speeds do reduce over time because of the congestion. So why was Bus Rapid Transit chosen for Cedar Avenue? We did go through the federal process of an alternatives analysis, so like Central Corridor, like Hiawatha, where we had to document the reasons why Bus Rapid Transit was the best. First, it did provide an alternative to congested roadways. We knew we weren't going to build our way out of congestion with roadways, that we needed to provide an alternative. We knew that Bus Rapid Transit provided fewer community impacts. A good example of that is that the existing Cedar Avenue Bridge could not hold the loads that would be imposed on it if light rail transit was an option. So the Cedar Avenue Bridge would have to be rebuilt to hold those LRT loads. So this provided us an opportunity to provide a lower cost solution without going through the environmental process that it would take to rebuild a river crossing in Minnesota. So a lower cost alternative than light rail, and then shorter implementation timelines. Because I think the note here is that we have existing transit needs, and this was one way for us to provide a solution right away in terms of those needs. BRT also provides flexibility. We can build facilities as demand grows. We don't have to build, 15 or 20 miles of improvements right away. We can build as the demand grows in the corridor. As ridership comes into the corridor, as development happens, we can respond to that. And the beauty of it, too, is we can phase it over time. Excuse me, and I can share that with you. The slide here shows the Cedar Avenue Transitway. The dots really kind of start in terms of stations at the Mall of America and 28th Avenue Park and Ride, existing stations that also have LRT service. As you work your way down, there are two stations in Eagan. That's the Cedar Grove and Cliff Road station. A few more stations in Apple Valley, starting in Palomino, 140th, 147th. Apple Valley Transit Station, which you heard about earlier, 161st and Glacier Way in Lakeville, and then continuing down Lakeville Cedar, 195th and 215th. This is the full vision by 2030. This doesn't represent what we would like to see built today, but it helps us respond to some of those immediate needs. And in the day where we have to look at where 1 + 1 = 3, I think this is an opportunity to share that with you, that not only would we have that station-to-station service at all of those dots, but express service will also be using the right-of-way as well and the facilities as well, as you heard through the UPA. And then clearly allowing folks that live or work in Dakota County to access downtown Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota, and St. Paul as well. So really we're getting kind of, a bang of 1 for 3 in this corridor. Just to walk through how the Cedar Avenue Transitway developed, again, sort of the beauty of this is that it is flexible and you can build over time. So as we take a snapshot today, we see the existing Mall of America station. The next station that you see south of there is a Cedar Grove Park and Ride facility. It is a UPA facility. Palomino Hills exists today. Apple Valley Transit Station, again, another Urban Partnership Agreement station. And the terminus right now, Lakeville Cedar at 181st. at the end of stage one, which is 2012, when we actually construct the bus shoulder lanes, you see that highlighted in the red rectangle, that we would actually build these bus shoulder lanes through Apple Valley and Lakeville, where they do not exist today. We also have additional stations that are more walk-up in nature, so they do not have park and ride facilities. Again, predominantly serving the neighborhoods and businesses in that area. So that's 140th and 147th, 161st as well. And again, Lakeville Cedar continues to be the terminus in that stage. During 2012 to 2020, kind of our second stage of development, we really just only add one additional station, and that's Glacier Way down in Lakeville. But we are also improving the corridor in terms of adding other facilities, other park and ride capacity as well. But this is that time where we can grow the corridor a little bit more in terms of ridership. And then the next stage of development is 2020 to 2030, and we see a Cliff Road station in Eagan, and then two additional stations in Lakeville, again, tied to development, tied to the demand when that occurs. Talk real quickly about the stations. Mr. Lamoth talked a little bit about the Apple Valley Transit Station. This is probably the highest level station in terms of an investment that you will see in the corridor. And the reason for that is you have local service at the station. You have express service and, of course, the station-to-station service. The picture that you see is the northbound station. So this is north on Cedar Avenue. Just off on the edge of the picture, you do see the park and ride facility, which is about a 750-stall park and ride. That opened up last January, and about 720 stalls were occupied the very next day it opened. So already we're looking at what we need to do to potentially expand that facility. When folks come home in the evening, you do see a vehicle there that's just about to pull up at the southbound station. They get off there. They walk through the Skyway safely over Cedar Avenue because it is about 150 feet wide in this area, and then they go right over to their vehicle. The transitway itself, like I mentioned, it will include the construction of dedicated bus shoulder lanes in Apple Valley and Lakeville. For the trunk highway portion on 77, we will continue to use the existing bus shoulder lanes to access the Mall of America and 28th Avenue. Station-to-station vehicles, pretty important as we've talked to business community and to our residents, and they said, you know, we really want this to be a unique vehicle for two reasons. Why? Because in the corridor, express service and local service will be also operating, so they want to be able to be at the station and go, that's my next vehicle because of its unique design. I think part of it, too, is that there's a need that folks said, we understand that light rail wasn't necessarily right as a fit for us, but we would still like a unique, designed, aerodynamic, environmentally responsible vehicle serving the corridor. So initially in 2012, when we would have station-to-station service, we would have about 10 40-foot vehicles. Those vehicles have a lifespan about approximately 12 years, and by that time, our ridership projections are showing that we would maybe have to move to a 60-foot articulated vehicle at that time. Fare collection, it is our hope that we would also have a fast and convenient fare collection, like ticket vending machines within the corridor, and that it would also the corridor would also be prepared for any other way of paying your fare within the corridor. We've worked with the Met Council and members of the county's Transit Improvement Board to also say that, you know, we know that the needs would be changing in this corridor, and we would like to do an annual review to make sure we have the right fare payment options within the corridor.
Ms. O'Connell, Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. O'Connell, I really appreciate these last two slides because when we did the original enabling legislation to do a study for 35 WBRT back in 2003, there's actually a definition in Minnesota state statute that defines BRT, and it talks about, you know, I think the kind of vehicles that you showed. I mean, we have expedited fare collection, expedited boarding, the low platforms. There's a few other parts to that definition, and I'm wondering if these vehicles sort of fit that, or if you're familiar with that definition, if you tried actually to be intentional about it, because one of the challenges, Mr. Chairman, with bus rapid transit as we talk about it further, and I think I appreciate that you were going to be doing that in this committee, is that it's really very vague in terms of people call a bus rapid transit. It could be an express bus that's a coach. I don't think we're fully at that definition on 35W. So I was kind of wondering if state statute had anything to do with this, or did you just come up with this on your own? Do you have the low platform and expedited boarding and all of that in these vehicles?
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to say that we were forward-thinking in saying that state statute directed us, but what we actually did was go around the country. You know, bus rapid transit operates in every environment around the country. We're not the first, but we're practically the newest to it. So as we looked at vehicles and, accordingly, stations, we wanted to make sure that those vehicles were able to bump up directly to the stations, because not only, obviously, is it convenient, but it also allows that faster boarding on and off, whether you're in a wheelchair or you have a stroller, but that level boarding was pretty important. These vehicles are going to have to really show and demonstrate them being unique. We're also looking at, like light rail, we know that many folks love to have their bike in the vehicle as opposed to on front of the vehicle, so we're also making accommodations for that. So our hope is that the vehicles, in conjunction with the stations and some of the technology pieces that I will talk about a little bit later, will get us to that bus rapid transit feature.
Good. Well, Mr. Chair, I think the region should look to Dakota County, I think, for some direction on this, and it's been a frustration of mine that people are using all kinds of definitions for BRT, but we actually do have something that approaches what you're doing in the state statute, and there's a reason for that. So thank you for your work on that.
Thank you for your comments. Ma'am, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we talk about vehicles, we do have to house those vehicles and make sure that they're warm and protected. So in our first two stages, working with Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, it looks like with the expansion of the Egan Garage, that facility could meet our initial needs. In 2025, again, when we kind of go to that larger vehicle, we may need to look at a new location. But I think sort of the creativity and the opportunity there is also to look at the fleet needs with I-35 WBRT, and is there an opportunity to have one location to house the fleet for both of those corridors. As we talk about technology is really important for bus rapid transit as well, again, because we partly have to get over a little bit of a mindset that, well, it's a bus and it can go somewhere else than the road that I'm on. It might take another road, and how do I know as a customer that I'm there? So technology is pretty important. First, we would like to see the transit signal priority for express and station-to-station vehicles. So what that means is that green stays a little bit longer when that bus is coming, or it might cycle through the red a little bit faster to get that bus through that intersection. Emergency vehicles will always have higher priority over transit vehicles, but during the AM and PM rush, pretty important that we get folks through. That real-time signs, like I said, about just sort of overcoming that information gap that we have with bus riders that says you are at the right place, your vehicle will be coming in the next 2 minutes, and just provide that assurance that you're where you need to be. And as we always know, that transit riders are either a pedestrian or a bike rider when they come to the stations or at their destinations. Very important that we paid attention about this in the Cedar Avenue Transitway. It is a principal arterial. It has multiple lanes. It's in a kind of noisy and the perception may be unsafe location. So we had to spend more time about making sure that people can walk there safely, that they can get to the stations, that we needed to do improved pedestrian crossings, and that there's wayfinding signage, because as we are a regional transitway, we know folks that are not from Dakota County will be using this, and we want to make sure that we're getting them to their ultimate destination. And also the importance of having the bike lockers and the in-vehicle bike racks that I spoke about earlier. So what makes this different? What kind of makes this unique, and sort of what is the new piece of this? As I work kind of left to right in the slide, you'll see that fall of 2012, when we anticipate the bus lane construction being completed, we will have the express service that you see in the red arrows there that continue to go into downtown Minneapolis. We will have the University of Minnesota service that originates out of Cedar Grove in Eagan. And then those black lines represent that station-to-station service, again, kind of mimicking that light rail station-to-station service. Our projections are looking right now that we might be able to handle between the two service projections on those black lines about every 10 to 15 minutes. And what we'd really like to do is get it closer to the 10 minutes, because then folks can throw that schedule away, and they know if they get to a station that they're going to have a vehicle show up within 10 minutes. And then, of course, within the transitway, we will also have express buses serving downtown St. Paul. What happens in year 2030 is that continues to happen, and basically what you're seeing is that increased frequencies for the AM and PM peak on the red, and then all of a sudden you see this hybrid. So we know that there's probably enough ridership by the year 2030 that we can do sort of like the skip-stop station service that you see on the far right of those red lines. So it would only operate maybe in the AM and PM peak, but it's just doing a little bit of a skip-stop station. We still see the University of Minnesota as being an important attraction, as well as the other lines of the station-to-station service, the other station stops coming online as well. So what do we get for this, for Bus Rapid Transit and offering this new service? Right now, the corridor is predominantly express, and we understand that there will be, and that will always be sort of the nature of this corridor. But by 2012, we do see the additional of about 2,200 trips coming into the corridor as the station to station, and that growing to about 3,600 by 2030. So you can see that between the corridor express and station to station by 2030, we're about 9,000. There's a number underneath there that also represents that local feeder service. So this also provides an opportunity to kind of get your east-west connections, kind of feeding that north-south line, and that there would be ridership that would be gained because there would be faster connections as there.
Ms. So, O'Connell, yes. These numbers we're looking at, are those bus trips per year, riders per day? What exactly are we looking here on projected ridership?
Mr. Chair, the numbers that you see there are trips. So if you would like to get, and that is trips on the transit system. So if you would, if you wanted to determine the riders, you would basically divide that in half, because one rider makes hopefully two trips.
Daily?
Daily, yes.
That's a daily ride. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The other benefit about this, as we talk about the infrastructure that's going in, is that it's also saving travel time for transit riders. And as we look into the future in 2030 and we kind of tease out the numbers for travel on both transit and auto, we see a real savings. At Lakeville 215th, which would be the ultimate terminus of the corridor, you're saving about approximately 22 minutes a trip, an AM trip or a PM trip, for example, if you were using the express service, going into downtown Minneapolis. So that's about 45 minutes a day, and multiply that times five days during the week, and that's real significant time folks are saving. As we talk about the full project, it is being done in stages. Our first stage in terms of the station-to-station improvements and the express BRT improvements is about $118 million. Stage 2 is about $55 million, as well as Stage 3. So the whole project is about $255 million for Cedar BRT. Again, it's not a cheap solution, but it's cheaper than some of the other alternatives that were available. This is always an exciting slide to explain. So what I would just like to share with you is that we are a federal project, but we are not a New Starts project, for which you would hear about some of the rail projects being a New Starts project. So our federal monies that have been coming to this project come from multiple sources and not just sort of one New Starts project. So ultimately, there's about 20-some different sources of funding between the federal, the state, the county's Transit Improvement Board, and also Dakota County, as well as our cities and the Regional Railroad Authority. It's a process to manage all of this, and it does have sometimes its difficulties, but it can be done outside of the Federal Transit Administration's New Starts project process. In terms of annual costs, the 2000 base year, which I said that it basically represents the express service that's there. Stage 1, when we add the station to station, it's an incremental cost of about $3.4 million. as the project builds out and has other stations, we're ultimately looking at an incremental cost of about $8 million in the last stage. Shared with you that this is a process that's been going on for 14 years. We did do a feasibility study in 1999 that kind of looked at the benefits of bus rapid transit. That was confirmed and basically sort of institutionalized in the corridor by the end of the alternatives analysis that was completed in 2004. So again, the point here is that we do have to go through the regular rigors that you would have to do for any sort of transit improvement. So we did do our alternatives analysis that identified bus rapid transit as the best. We've completed our engineering and design and actually just awarded a contract for the bus shoulder construction in January of this year. That award was 17% under our engineer's estimate, so we're very happy about that. And then looking at how we could maybe reassign some of that those monies into the project. A few things do need to happen. We still need to build a couple more stations. We need to get through construction as well. We need to acquire those vehicles. But the hope is that by fall of 2012, we will have a new mode of transit within the transit arena. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any questions you or the committee may have.
Members, questions for the presentation, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. O'Connell, if I can take you back to page 2, the bottom slide. Basically, the corridor growing pains, increasing congestion. Question on the Cedar Avenue, County Road, Highway 42, excuse me. The daily traffic that's measured at the intersection, is it predominantly north-southbound traffic, or is that a comparable component going east and west on County Road 42?
Ms. Schoen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that number that you see there, 70,000, is the northbound, north and south traffic that's measured. County Road 42, which is also one of our most highly traveled roads, the east-west ADT on that is about 40,000. So it is probably the busiest intersection that we have in Dakota County.
Members, further questions? Well, thank you for a pretty clear presentation on how the Cedar BRT is going. It's apparent that it's a work in process, that we're getting some numbers, we're getting some results, but there's still a lot of work to be done to fill out the station plan and the amount of buses and so on and so forth. And, of course, things that happen on 35 heading into Minneapolis will have a big impact on it, too, because that's where you're heading. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the presentation. Members, in your packet also, I want to point out just a moment here, for just a moment, that there is a group called the 35W Solutions Alliance, which is a consortium of several cities from Minneapolis to Lakeville, I think, Bob. In fact, if Mr. Tennyson wants to come up, just give us about a two-minute overview of Solutions Alliance, 35W Solutions, that'd be great. And we could appreciate the work that you did to help bring the units together to make the UPA work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney, and I represent the I-35W Solutions Alliance, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here. With me this afternoon to make the presentation is the chair of the 35W Solutions Alliance, Sue Sandall, who also is a city council member in the city of Richfield. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
ma'am.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just share with you what the 35W Solutions Alliance was able to bring to the table for both the UPA and with the bus rapid transit that you just heard about. 35W Solutions Alliance is a joint powers agreement of cities and counties all along the 35W corridor south of Minneapolis. It includes the cities of Bloomington, Burnsville, Dakota County, Elko New Market, Hennepin County, Lakeville, Minneapolis, Richfield, Savage, and Scott County. And one of the benefits of the Solutions Alliance is all of these all of these communities get together, together with MnDOT, Metro Transit, Met Council representatives, and legislators are also invited to attend to discuss all of the transportation issues up and down the 35W corridor. And when the UPA proposal first came to our attention, all of our members were very interested and participated in the initial discussions. and we're able to serve as an advocate and a sounding board for the 35W project as it proceeded. The UPA was able to meet with one group in addition to other groups that they met with that represented all of those communities and interests. And the benefit that the 35W Solutions Alliance was able to provide was because we've had a long-standing working relationship among all of those members, there was a trust element in place. We had an interest in transportation up and down the corridor. We could see the big picture, and were able to proceed to encourage the UPA to consider 35W as the selected corridor. Part of the benefit of the Solutions Alliance is that because we have invited and have MnDOT sitting at our table on a regular basis, we were familiar with all of the projects that they had already proposed and were able to encourage them to proceed with the UPA project, which I think has been, as we've just heard, a very successful project in reducing traffic congestion and helping traffic flow. And so we just wanted to share with you our interest in the corridor and to let you know all of the legislators in our area are most welcome to attend. We do provide notices to them to encourage them to attend, and Chair Beard was there recently at one of our recent meetings. So that was my report.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to draw your attention to the recognition that the 35W Solutions Alliance received in its role. I think the materials are submitted to you there. And they were, we reckon, in the study of the project afterwards, the Humphrey Institute did a study, and they said that the role of the 35 Solutions Alliance in the process and selection of the corridor was critical, because we were able to be a forum for discussion and resolution of issues that came up, and we were a ready place. I think it was also very important the fact that this organization existed to speed up the process, and the, as you heard earlier, that the state was under a very tight deadline to meet the requirements of the UPA, and since we were already there, been working together for 20 years, it was an easy forum for them to come to and reach an agreement.
Thank you for your service in helping to facilitate that. We had to pull some things together pretty quickly. I might point out, too, that our former colleague in the House, former Mayor Dan McElroy of Burnsville, helped put this project, put the Solutions Alliance together back in the 1990s. Just one housekeeping item. Suzanne, if you'd say your name again for the tape, the Secretary didn't quite get it.
Certainly, it's Suzanne Sandahl.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Representative Szymanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to ask Mr. Tennyson. You said that you were under extreme tight deadlines to get these projects moving and so forth. Any tips or advice on how did you expedite the projects to get it done in the time
Tennyson. Mr. Chairman, Representative, MnDOT had a very tight timeline to get this project approved, and they had to consult with a lot of the local governments along the route to do that. They were able to come to us without having to go to, you know, 8 or 10, whatever the number of communities were along the route, and negotiate with them. Our organization has been in existence, and many of you have been there, and they were able to come to us and get that approval. And then also there had to be a certain amount of trust, because Minneapolis had to go out on a limb a little bit and make commitments ahead of time before the deal was completed, is my recollection, in order to meet the construction deadline. They had to commit to tearing up Marquette and Second Avenue before the whole deal was put together. And there were some issues that got worked out, but I think that was when that helped that process. So I think, over the 20 years of existence of the 35W Solutions Alliance, the cities and the counties along that route have developed a confidence in each other, and realizing that they're going to have to compromise on some things that they have, like on the crosstown. City of Minneapolis and the city of Richfield had to give up some properties, and it was, which properties you give up to expand the route and that sort of thing. So we were able to do that. And the other part on the, there was a question about the getting onto the express lane when you're heading south or the pay lane. I think that got worked out with Minneapolis. Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Members, thank you. And thank you, Ms. Jensen and Ms. Sandahl. Sorry, Suzanne, I should know your last name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's time for my afternoon nap, I guess. So let's adjourn, members. But before we do, let me remind you that on Monday we will be upstairs in room 5. Wednesday's down here. Monday's upstairs. We are adjourned. We'll see you then.